to the Web 2.0 show with your hosts, Josh Owens
and Chris Saylor. We're a show about the new web,
the latest thoughts and technology behind internet development and content delivery. Welcome to episode 9. We have Jason Fried with us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jason, your background, where you're from, things of that nature.
Sure. I'm from Chicago. I live in Chicago now, too, so I'm kind of a Chicagoan. I actually went to school out in Arizona, though. I took some time off from the Midwest and decided to head out to Arizona for 4 years and got a degree, actually, in finance. So my background is really more in business and finance than it is in design or technology. And I don't really know a whole lot about technology. I'm more of a design/business guy, and I've always kind of liked design. Design's always been something I've been interested in ever since my dad used to bring home annual reports. My dad's a trader, stock trader, so he used to bring home annual reports all the time, and I always loved looking at the charts and the graphs and the statistics and the numbers and the whole thing, and how realizing how text and numbers could make designs. You didn't have to always have graphics to make a design. And so that kind of got me involved in design and got interested in design, and I just dabbled in design for a long time. And then I graduated from college in 96. So around 95, the web started to finally, started to hit pretty much. And I said, hey, I could do this. I could make a business out of this. I can actually design interfaces, which I've always loved to do, but really didn't do it for anybody. Let's see what happens. So I started doing some freelance work here and there. And back then it was pretty easy to pick up jobs because, no one was an expert. No one was doing anything. It was all brand new. So I started doing that. And kind of did that freelance for about 4 years, working out of my house. And in 99, I hooked up with a guy named Matt Linderman, hired him as my first employee, and he's still with us today. Then I hooked up with two other guys who became partners in 37 Signals, and we started 37 Signals in 1999, and those two guys have left since, now there's a total of seven of us here at 37 Signals.
Wow, that's very cool. You want to just run down the guys in your team and what they do?
Sure, yeah. So one other thing I'll mention, too, is 37 Signals actually originally started as a web design consulting firm. Mm-hmm. So we were just doing other people's websites, and we turned into a product development firm in February 2004, and we'll talk more about that later, I suspect. But as far as the team goes, it's myself, David Hanmeyer Hansen, who is the guy who invented Ruby on Rails.
Right.
He just actually got a visa, so he's here in Chicago now. He's from Copenhagen, Denmark, and he'll be here for a few years at least, which is great. We have Matt Linderman, who I mentioned earlier. Matt's a designer. David, obviously, is a programmer. Matt's a designer. We have Ryan Singer here in Chicago, who's a designer. We have Jameis Buck, who actually is based in Provo, Utah. He's a programmer. And we just hired two more guys, a guy named Sam Stevenson, who is a programmer, and Marcel Molina, who's also a programmer.
Yeah, those guys formed, was it Ionist?
Yeah. Yeah, those guys formed a company called Ionis together, and we actually talked to Sam before we hired Jameis. We talked to Sam, and Sam and Jameis were two finalists for who we were going to hire as our second programmer, and we ended up hiring Jameis, but we really liked Sam as well, but we just couldn't hire two people. So we kept in touch with Sam, and then Sam hooked up with Marcel, and then a couple months ago we talked to them again about both joining 37 Signals, and so they did that on December 1st.
Very cool.
Now, 37 Signals has a unique corporate philosophy that you guys, expound on your blog all the time. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what do you think is unique about it? Maybe I can touch on that, because sometimes it's hard from my vantage point to talk about things that, it's hard to tell what people think is different and think is unique, because I'm around it all the time. So maybe if you want to talk about a couple things, I could definitely riff on that.
Well, the first is that less is more.
Right.
Obviously. And the second is your focus on actually design first as opposed to developing a back end and then slapping on a design
sure.
in the front.
Sure. I can touch on those. The whole less is more thing, there's a lot of different ways to frame that. For whatever it's worth, I don't like the term less is more, because to me that implies that more is better. So I just, whatever. We're big fans of the idea of less. Basically what we mean by that is less everything. and it less structured your company, less red tape, less people, less features in your software, less support to have to provide because your software is simpler, less interface, less screens, less pages, everything less. And I think that the idea is that if you want to compete today, you can certainly try and play the old game, which is trying to one-up everybody and outdo everybody. And while that may work for some, it's very expensive, and it's kind of a defensive kind of Cold War posture. It's, hey, this guy just launched this feature. Let's launch this one or these two. And so we've decided we want to go the other way and underdo people and basically ship very simple, very focused tools that do a few things really well and then just simply get out of your way. And so that's kind of the whole mentality and the philosophy behind 37 Signals and the kind of products that we develop. And a lot of that does have to come or does come from the fact that we do the interface design first. So some companies, I think most companies, will do the back-end development for a product first, the coding and the infrastructure and whatnot, and then kind of paint the interface on at the end. And I think that that's backwards. I think that the way to build great products and great tools for the web, at least, is to start from the customer experience, and which is essentially the interface for the most part. I mean, of course, there's more to it than that, but the interface is where you start. And you build the shell, you build the interface, you fake what this product's going to actually do because you don't have a back end yet to do it, but you build all the screens that you click through and you work through it that way. And then at the end, once you've developed the whole interface and the customer experience, then you actually plug in the back end and hook it all up so it actually works. And we find that what that allows us to do is stay in front of the customer experience for the longest possible time. So instead of being in front of the customer experience for 20% of the project at the end, we're in front of the customer experience for 90% of the project. And basically that means like our first version is like someone else's version 2 or 3 as far as interface design goes. That's why we try and really, that's why I think a lot of people consider our products to be well designed from an interface perspective, is because we've actually kind of redesigned them a few times during the process. And I think when you leave the interface for the end, you never have time to redesign it and to tweak it and to adjust it before it launches. Yeah. So that's kind of the overarching sort of philosophy of 37 Signals.
Yeah. That actually makes sense to me, is to you know, develop the interface first. But that kind of goes actually against a lot of IT books, you know, for classic development projects.
Sure, sure.
And I've gotten into arguments with, you know, other programmers that, hey, this way actually works.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's like really whatever works for you is really what's most important. I know we get a lot of flack for preaching our way and people suggest that we think our way is the only way, and that's just not true at all. So I think whatever works for you is what you should do, but you should certainly be open to other ways of working. That, I think, is the key. Before we started doing it this way, I know I at least used to do it the old way, do a lot of charts and graphs and flow charts and diagrams and all this stuff. And then do the programming first, and the programmer would give us kind of the skeleton app, which then we'd make look nice. And it never really worked right. So we decided to do it a more natural way, and this is what we've come up with.
Now, the Agile Web Development with Rails book, have you read that?
I haven't read it completely because I'm not much of a programmer. I should read it, yeah, though, and I do plan on finishing, but I haven't finished it yet.
There's like a development methodology in there where you actually sit down with the customer and with your laptop, and you ask him some questions, and you actually start building the interface in Rails. It's like, you know, you generate some scaffold, you start changing the screens around, and the customer asks for a feature, you go build it in, and it's kind of a, you know, it's small, very small iterations. And I was wondering if the way the book is laid out is how you guys at 37 Signals actually develop applications.
Well, the interesting thing about the way we do things is that we are our customer. So everything that we build for ourselves. And we realize that, hey, you know, if we need this, it's likely that hundreds of thousands of other people just like us will need this. So we don't really sit down in front of customers. And we consider ourselves to be the customers. We build the tool that we need first. And then once we launch it, then we listen to people who are actually using it out in the real world and get their feedback and consider changes, say yes to some and no to most, and tweak and adjust nonstop. So we do listen to customers, but the customers are ourselves first and then our actual customers after we've launched the product. We do think it's important to innovate on behalf of your customers, and I think this is something that Steve Jobs talks about a lot. You know, the perfect example is the iMac losing the floppy drive. You know, if you were to ask people about that, they would have said, no way, you can't do it. He said, you know what, we're doing it. And that's the way it's going to be, because we think that we're going to innovate here. We think this is the way things are going to be going. And someone needs to take that first step. So oftentimes we'll take the first step. We may piss some people off here and there or whatever, but you can't make everyone happy all the time. So you just have to make as many people happy as you can who believe in what you believe. We're not trying to build products that everybody in the world loves. You know, we're trying to build products that a certain fraction of the people in the world really love, but really, really love, passionately love, and are fans of. And I think that one of the best ways to do that is to build things for yourself, because you're very passionate about what you're building, and then realize there's going to be lots of other people out there just like you.
Yeah.
But as far as being agile, we're absolutely agile. Everything about us is agile and iterative and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I would think most web services, you can't really sit down with a customer because you don't have one specific customer as a web service. So.
Yeah, there's certainly ways to do this. I mean, there's companies out there who will go find customers for you and conduct interviews for you or set up focus groups or whatever. And some people think that works. I don't think it works, but some people think it works. And if it works for them, then that's fine. But that's not the route that we take.
Right.
It really goes back to the whole open source scratching an itch thing, really. I mean, you're kind of building something for yourself.
Totally. I just think that's the way to build great products, is to build something for yourself. I mean, at the end of the day, everyone cares about themselves more than anybody else, really. And I think that if you do that, if you realize that, you build something for yourself, you're just going to care about what it is that you're building more. I mean, if you're doing work, and the way to figure this out is, like, if you're doing work for a client and you also have your own personal project on the side, you're always more passionate about that personal project. You're always more passionate about the thing that you're actually building that's going to be built for you. And so we try and just realize that that's the human condition and just how things are for the most part. And so we kind of make ourselves the customer there.
Isn't that the truth? I know we talk with Jeff Barr, who always has a side project, and he's the Amazon web affiliates guy, and he works, first thing in the morning and last thing at night, he works on his side project.
Yeah, because it's a labor of love.
Yeah.
And
the
cool thing is when you can have your labor of love being exactly what you do all day, then you're in a perfect position to build great tools. And hopefully we're getting there. We're close to as close as we think we can get right now to that.
That's very cool. So one of the debates that I've seen going about on your website, especially with some of the Rails stuff, you had Rails is a Web 2.0 technology. What would be your definition of Web 2.0, and what do you think about this whole thing?
Honestly, I haven't given much thought to the definition. I posted something a while back about, what it's not.
Right.
And it's not Ajax, and it's not Ruby on Rails, and it's not any of this technology stuff. A lot of people say it's about people, but yeah, of course it's about people. It's always been about people. I don't think that's new either. Hopefully, in my mind, hopefully what it means is simple, focused, clear, elegant tools that just do a few things really well and then get out of your way. I just think software gets in your way too much. It's trying to be too clever and solve too many problems. So hopefully software starts solving less problems, not more problems. And I think that's kind of what's going on right now. You're starting to see very simple, focused tools that do a few things. And I think that's great. I mean, it's just like craftsmen and people who really care about getting something done don't use all-purpose tools. They use simple tools that do something really well, something that's designed for one specific purpose. And I hope to see more of those sorts of tools out there. And also, I guess the other thing that I think's sort of nice about what's going on today, at least to a bigger degree than it was before, is that I think people are trying to turn these ideas into businesses. And so that's always something that it's great to see. It's a little bit more walk, a little bit less talk, and hopefully that continues. Although there's still an awful lot of talk, but I think there's just more walking these days than there was a few years back. So that's pretty nice.
There is some fear that, there's kind of a bubble going on, but to be honest, there actually aren't that many services that I see that are really being built to flip or built with no solid business plan in mind. At least, I don't know, that's just my opinion. I guess there's more business plans now than there were in the first boom.
Yeah, it seems like it. But I think you're also seeing more things coming out of these business plans or whatever you want to call them. I just think there's more apps now. There's more deliverables now, which is good. As far as there being a bubble, I mean, I don't know. I don't even know what that means. I mean, the bubble before was clearly a stock market bubble, and that's a true bubble. The bubble now, like a few companies making it or not making it, that's not a bubble. That's just natural business. That's just how things are. Like, not everybody makes it. Most people don't. I don't think the fact that there's a lot of tools being launched means there's a bubble at all. I think some of these valuations may be a bit bubbly, But, you know, who knows? I don't think any of us really know. Like, some people will say Delicious got bought for $20 million or $30 or $10, or who really knows? And who really understands the real economics behind that deal, except for the people involved? So I think it's easy to just say, oh, these guys got a great deal, or these guys, you know, paid way too much. You know, who really knows until later? But that being said, I mean, to see certain valuations out there, I'm a little bit surprised by the numbers. But, you know, I don't know a whole lot about how this stuff works, so even though I have a finance degree. But that doesn't mean anything anymore, so I don't know.
You've touched upon being kind of experts at UI design. How did you get to that point, since you yourself started out in finance?
As a matter of fact, you guys have, I mean, you have three designers on your team. I know, you know, some people would actually see that as a lot, but I myself enjoy design as well, and I think that's a good number.
I made myself an expert, and we all did. None of us have any design background whatsoever. There's been a total of, let's see, probably like six or seven designers at 37 Signals over the last 5 years or so, and not one of them has had formal design training. I'm a finance major. Matt got his degree, I believe, in political science. Ryan's kind of a philosophy buff. Ernest, who was one of the original partners, who's an interface designer, his degree is in jazz performance. I mean, we all just come from different backgrounds. And I think that actually gives us a huge advantage, because we don't look at the web, or look at interface design, I should say, as some sort of, you know, art project or composition, or like look at it from an academic design perspective. We just look at it from, you know, a normal person's perspective, who doesn't have any design training or doesn't understand what these design things are. It just needs to make sense. So I think that gives us a bit of an advantage over people who may have some academic design baggage. Not that it's necessarily always a bad thing at all. There's a lot of stuff that's really useful, especially typography, which is a great thing to learn. A formal typography, if you can learn it. But I do think, from what I see out there, is that there's a lot of design, and there's a lot of academic design going on. And I hope we start to see a little bit less of that. And I think we are. Less structured stuff and a little bit looser, things are a little bit looser and just a little bit friendlier, not so cold. And I think we're starting to see a bit of that coming around. But as far as the size of our design team, I actually think designers should have an equal number of designers and programmers. And we've recently flipped on that. So we have four programmers now and three designers. And I think that's about right too. A lot of companies will go and hire a bunch of programmers and then outsource their design. And I think that's dangerous. It may sort of work, but it's not the ideal match, I don't think, or the ideal ratio. I think you definitely want to have the equal number of designers and programmers. Or, you know, or again, less of everybody. So if you're saying, hey, we can't have that many programmers or that many designers because we have 20 programmers, well, maybe you should have five programmers. What do you need 20 programmers for? And start thinking about things in that way as well.
I want to switch track a little bit. Now, one of the things that makes Rails as a development framework unique is that it was actually extracted out of Basecamp. How did that process work? And I guess, did you guys realize you had a framework after you built Basecamp, or was it your intention to build a framework in the first place?
No, it was never our intention to build a framework. David's philosophy on this, and I agree with it completely, is that frameworks should always be extracted, because they're the result of solving real problems and not trying to think about problems you may or may not have or anticipate problems, but actually solving real problems. And so I'm a big fan of this idea of extraction. You'd have to ask David specifically about when he realized that there was a framework here. But I think it came down to the fact that he was just doing a few things over and over and over, repeating himself, and realized, hey, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that I'm going to need to use again. Maybe I should pull this out so it's a little bit easier so I don't repeat myself. And I think that's how Rails was born. But there was definitely not a conscious decision beforehand to build Rails. I mean, Basecamp itself originally was just for ourselves. We built it for ourselves and didn't really have much of an idea of really, much intention of making it into a product until we get a little bit further along in it. So, you know, a lot of stuff that we do is kind of happens by accident. We learn things along the way and we go for it. And we're not afraid to fail and make mistakes, and make mistakes out in public either. I don't think anyone should be afraid of making mistakes in public like that. So I think if you keep your open mind like that, you're going to see a lot of opportunities that you may not have spotted otherwise. That's just a big thing about us too. We don't plan much. We don't have a roadmap of where we're going, with the exception of maybe the next few weeks. We just limit it to that, and then we'll see what happens, and we'll adapt when we need to adapt. And I think if you have these long-term plans and like these long-term ideas sometimes, you just get blinded by them, actually. And you're like, I have to do this because I said I would do this in 5 years, and then you miss out on it. So Rails, I think, is a good example of that. We didn't plan on building a framework, but it just kind of happened. We saw it, or David saw it, I should say. David saw it and said, hey, this is a framework here. I want to make it easier to build apps, and I want to make it easier to build apps for other people, and let's go ahead and do this. So I think that's a side effect of just not having a plan, which is scary for some, but I don't think it should be that scary.
Many would consider you a Web 2.0 industry leader. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, I'm flattered by it, and I'm honored by it if people consider me to be a leader. I mean, I don't set out to be a leader consciously. I certainly am vocal and have things to say about what's going on, and I've always been a big fan of sharing my ideas and speaking out. So if people are inspired by those and they want to follow them, that's great. But it's definitely not something that I consciously make an effort to do. I don't like being a pundit. I'm not here just to, like, criticize. We're actually building things. We're actually doing things. We have a real business with real revenues, and, I'd like to share whatever insights we have that we figure out along the way, so it helps other people. So I guess if that's the definition of a leader, then I'll accept that. But I do think that leaders should be doing the things that they're talking about doing. There's a lot of leaders out there in the design world, especially, who like to talk about design a lot, or like to talk about usability a lot, or whatever, and they don't do that sort of work. So I the kind of people that I like to follow and I like to look up to are the people who are actually doing the work that they're talking about doing. Hopefully that's us.
Yeah, that's kind of been our idea with this podcast, is to talk to the developers making things, making the next generation of web services, and talking to them, helping other people get ideas, get inspired, and figure out how to get started as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's never been easier to do this. That's not to say that it's easy, but it's never been easier to do this. And I encourage everybody to build things. Take control a little bit of their, or take more control of their creative destinies, essentially, or their business destinies, and go build something and build it on the side. I mean, you know, Basecamp was built 10 hours a week from David's time. David was in school getting his degree, and he had client work, side projects. We had client work and stuff, and we could only really dedicate 10 hours a week to Basecamp. We still built it in about three and a half months. So this idea that you don't have any time to do something, obviously Basecamp's changed a lot since we launched it, but the idea that you don't have enough time to do something is something that I think you should revisit. If you can squeeze 5 hours a week out of your time, I think you're going to be able to build something. And it'll also focus you and force you to be simple and make simple decisions and build a simple product that people are actually going to use, because you don't have a lot of time to make it complex. So I think the constraints of less time are something that you should really embrace and not try and get rid of.
For our listeners, that's your goal. Wake up 1 hour early and every day this week and start building something.
You could. Why not? You know, you could definitely build something, no doubt. And especially, you know, remember this. Part of that time that David was spending was actually building Rails, and he didn't know it. And now Rails exists. So if you want to use Ruby on Rails, you're going to save yourself a huge amount of time right up front, because you're not going to have to do all the dirty work that you would normally have to do. So, you know, Rails makes it easy to build an app in 7 hours a week. Let's put it that way.
You get to use all that pretty magical voodoo stuff that David built.
Yeah, I can't talk too much about that. You'll have to talk to him specifically about that stuff, but he is a bit of a magician, I think.
You know, we talked about VC a little bit earlier. Most of the people we've talked to on the show for web services are entertaining VC or already have gotten it. You guys are a little bit different in that. I think you've talked about it on your blog a little bit, but have you had offers to purchase 37 Signals, and do you plan on not taking it?
We've had a lot of offers from VCs to invest. We've talked to a little bit over 20, maybe 30. I don't really remember VCs who want to put some money into our company. And that's, again, it's very flattering. I mean, it's pretty amazing, I think, and it's pretty cool to be able to build something that other people like want to invest in. But we're not interested in VC money at all. We're self-funded, and we plan on remaining self-funded. That's not to say that we wouldn't sell like a piece of it, for example, to someone who we think has a like mind and has the same vision. Not as a VC, not as like a cash infusion so much, but just someone to kind of partner with and come along and share some ideas. I don't typically like the VC approach to things. I'd rather work with somebody who actually owns another business and is running it as well and has some insight there, or has done this sort of thing before. As far as offers to purchase 37 Signals outright, we had some people talk to us about things like that, but there's nothing that we've heard so far that's really attractive to us. You know, everyone has their price, and certainly, you know, if the right deal came along, we'd entertain it. But our goal has never been to build something to sell it. And as you mentioned earlier today, this idea of the flip, you know, I think Jason Calcanis talked about this with you guys too, is this idea that you need to build something to build it. You shouldn't be building something to sell it. If a sale is a pleasant side effect of being successful, but if you build something to flip it, the odds are really against you. So I think if you're going to build something and you care about it, you need to build it to build it. And the other thing that I'll mention is that, you know, I can't speak for all of history, of course, but in the history that I've been around for, I don't know of any companies that have been built, any great companies that have been built exclusively to sell. I mean, great companies are built to build great companies, not to sell to somebody else. And so if that's your goal up front, to build something to sell, I would have second thoughts about that strategy.
Yeah, I agree. Just seems like visualization is, I find, a very good technique, and kind of have to visualize a better endpoint than building to flip.
Yeah, and it's hard, too. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know what people think, but I have the perception that there's a lot of people out there who are building things with the idea that, you know, Yahoo's going to buy them for $20 million or whatever. And, like, first of all, to even get that conversation is incredibly hard. And then to even come to a deal is incredibly – I mean, it's incredibly hard to build something to sell it and just to even have a deal get done. So I think it's nice to fantasize about that sort of thing, but it's a lot easier to get a few thousand people to pay for your product than it is to sell it to Yahoo off the bat.
If you're building something that you enjoy doing, your passion is going to come through in that. And really, you know, the rest of it will probably take care of itself.
Yeah, so if you're building something because you think Yahoo's going to buy it, and you start making decisions like, how would this work with Yahoo, or how would Yahoo prefer me to do this? I mean, forget about it. You're not going to build a great product. And hey, it can work. You can win that lottery. But the odds are definitely stacked against you. The odds are stacked against you for success anyway. But at least if you have a little bit more control over your financial destiny by having paying customers, then you just have a little bit more control. And if you're just going to say, I have, you know, it's Yahoo or bust, then I think you're making a bad decision.
I think Jason touched on it a little bit in the interview we had with him when he talked about going into AOL. They came to him and wanted to purchase Weblogs Inc. And he was able to say, well, we're going to make this amount of money because we have this many people that are reading our websites. And he was able to get the deal he wanted. He was able to fight for the points he wanted when it was purchased.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, he has leverage. When you have real customers and real revenue, you have leverage. And if you're just some person who's building some tool and you think, I was going to pay $20 million for it, companies will pay you more if you have an option. I mean, that's just how you have to negotiate. If you have no other option, your price goes way down. Calcanis had other options. He had customer. Well, you know, he had advertising revenues and exposure. And that's an alternative that he had. That's a negotiating point that he had in his favor. Right. And I think he's absolutely right about that. You have to build a company first, and then you have more power to do the deal if you do want to do the deal.
Mm-hmm. So I guess to switch gears here a little bit, where in the world did you guys get the idea for 37 Better? Was it just daily frustration, or what was that?
Yeah, so the 37 Better project was something we launched, I think, in like 2001 or so. I don't remember. I think it was 2001, though. I was using these online banks at the time, and online banks have certainly gotten better. They're not as good as I think they could be, but they're definitely better. But at the time, they were horrible. They were disastrous. And so I decided one night just to like build what I thought would be a better online bank, just the interface, and just one screen. I mean, it's not a whole bank. It's just one screen. And so I built it, or designed it, just kind of for myself, just to like burn off some steam, basically. And like a month or two later, I said, hey, you know what? I'll just put this online, and maybe people will think it's useful or whatever. Who knows? And I did that and called it 37 Better Bank. And people really loved it, and they loved the idea of taking one page and making it better. And so we've done a few more. We did a 37 Better PayPal, 37 Better Google, 37 Better
FedEx,
right? The FedEx one was pretty popular. And then we also did this thing called 37 Better Motors, which was an idea that Ernest Kim had, who was a partner of 37 Signals, to do. It wasn't a redesign of anything. It was just more of an idea that he put out there, this idea of automotive telematics being web-based, so you could kind of log into your car and upload MP3s and whatever and do all the stuff over the web and check out, you know, where your car is, to leave your windows open, things like that, and lock your doors and stuff like that. So we put that out there, too, is under the 37 Better umbrella. It's a way to complain but be constructive about it. And I think a lot of people complain and are not constructive at all. So it's just a nice way of complaining, I think.
Whenever I see someone give you, feedback, I want it to be constructive. I always say, you know, if you have a problem with something, come with a solution in hand, mm-hmm. and something's more likely to get fixed.
Totally.
Like, if you see a bug, come to me with how you think it should work instead of how it is working now, and we'll most likely get that fixed for you quicker.
Yeah, it comes down to human nature, too. When someone has a problem with what you're doing, if they're, you know, polite about it and respectful and have something to offer you, it's more likely that you're going to take them seriously and pay attention to their issues and solve them than if somebody just says, hey, you know, this feature sucks, you know, what the fuck? Well, I mean, we get emails like that, you know. It's like, all right, well, fine, but, you know, right, you just went to the bottom of my list. You know, I'm not going to pay attention to that right now because there's other people who are respectful who have, you know, have other problems that we can take care of and feel better about taking care of them first. So it's just a matter of respect, and this has nothing to do with the web. It's just, you know, the world. Hopefully, people are a little bit more respectful one another. But and we're guilty of being disrespectful from time to time too. But I think on balance, we try and be as civil as we can, but still kind of be as blunt as we can. I also don't like to watch my words much. I just like to say kind of what's on my mind. So sometimes that gets me into trouble, but so be it. That's fine. But yeah, I agree. If you're going to offer some criticism, you know, come with a suggestion or at least give me some idea on why you're criticizing it, not just to, you know, be a dick.
Right.
I was actually curious. The 37 Better idea, what came first, that or your philosophy on the interface first? I guess which one grew out of the other?
I've always kind of believed in the interface first. I should actually tell you, like, way back before I got out of college, I was building these FileMaker Pro products, FileMaker Pro-based products for organizing your music collection, organizing your book collection, and organizing your video collection. So I'm not a programmer, but FileMaker Pro was a really easy thing to build. And that's kind of one of the ways I kind of got started with interface design, is I was actually designing the interfaces for these little tools that I was coding in FileMaker Pro. And I would do the interface first, and then, like, figure out how to make them work later. And that just was a side effect of the fact that I didn't know how to make them work at all. So what I knew how to do was design the interface. And so I could do that. And then I could say, shit, I have this interface. I got to make it work now. So let me read the book and figure out how to do that. So I've always kind of felt that that's the best way to think through your ideas, is to think through them visually. And also, like, you can't click a piece of paper. You know, you can't click a box on a chart that represents a button. But you can click a button, you can click a link, and you can click things that are real on the screen. So I've just always felt like you should start from that point and then work out, instead of, like, you know, going from these abstract boxes and arrows and charts and diagrams and text, and then try to build an interface from that. So that's just something I've always personally believed, and everyone else at 37 Signals also has that distinct notion of what makes a good interface design. And I think that they all sort of believe also that you have to start from that point. And I think that's kind of why we all work really well together, is we share that common vision of how to build tools.
That's very cool. So I think we've come to that point in the podcast where I always ask, what big secret do you want to reveal right here on the podcast? What is your company going to be working on that you just want to announce right here on the podcast?
Sure. Well, we have four products that we're thinking about. We have two that we're actually working on right now, actively working on. I can't say a whole lot about them, but two of them will hopefully be out in January. Hopefully by the end of January. What can I tell you about them? One of them has to do with group communication, real-time group communication. So I'll leave it at that. But it solves like five problems that's wrong with the way people are sort of doing it now. So, or I think four or five problems that the way people are doing it now, it solves those. So that's one. And the other thing we're working on right now is like a CRM-ish sort of tool for small businesses. We kind of want to redefine what CRM is for small teams, just like we defined what project management collaboration was with Basecamp for small teams. So we're working on those two tools, and hopefully we'll have those out by the end of January. But like I said, we don't really plan too far ahead, so they'll be released when they're ready. And of course, they'll be released without the beta tag. We're huge enemies of the beta tag. I think that that's like one of the most ridiculous things that's going on today, actually, is the beta tag. So whenever we release our products, they're released for real. People can use them for real, and we'll stand behind them from day one. We won't make excuses for them. We won't say, it's beta, you know, whatever. This is our product. This is what we're offering to the market, and hopefully you'll like it. And if there's problems, we'll fix it. But we feel confident enough in this product that we're here to release it to you, and you should trust it as a real product, a real finished product. So
the whole beta thing just makes it seem like you're trying to build a business, you're trying to build a product, and you want people to pay for it. You know, don't slap beta on it. Which also goes hand-in-hand, of course, with if you have less features, of course, you can actually, you know, build it in less time. You don't have to release a beta.
Right. Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with beta, but public betas, I think, are just ridiculous. They're not betas. They're out there for the public to use. I mean, it's real at that point. And, like, to me, it's just a cover-your-ass thing. I mean, I really don't understand it. Unless it's being used as a marketing tool now, which I don't buy either. I think that there's a few people who understand what this stuff means, and the other 95% are really confused by it. But, you know, if it's this thing, well, it's not quite ready, so, well, if it's not quite ready, don't let the public use it. You know, let your private testers use it. If you're going to let the public use it, it better be ready. And the other thing to understand is that everything's, you know, the beautiful thing about web-based software is it's changing all the time anyway. I mean, to say that your 1.0 release is the final version you'll ever release is just ridiculous. So you don't need to slap beta tags on things. People recognize that things are changing all the time now, and that there's going to be updates. You know, we update our products all the time, sometimes twice a day, sometimes not, you know, for 2 weeks. It just depends. But you don't need this beta tag. As long as things essentially work, then you're fine. And again, like you mentioned, when you build simple tools, which I think everyone's version one should be it should be 200% simpler than they initially intended. So you should, I got my percentages wrong there. Basically, you should cut your vision in half. And, you know, if you want to launch, you know, X, Y, Z, just launch X or X and Y, but keep the Z for later. And you can always add stuff later. So if you're going to either launch this huge beta or you're going to launch something that's smaller and much, much more refined, I would suggest you release the smaller one that's much more refined. I think you're just better off doing that. And also, you know, this idea, this beta thing is weird because, like you said, if people are trying to build products and build businesses, a beta sounds like, you know, our doors aren't quite open yet. You shouldn't really trust us yet. Don't expect us to be open tomorrow either because we might be, you know, renovating the space or who knows. You know, it just doesn't send a good message, I don't think.
Or even worse, don't put your real data in here because I might lose it.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing. It's like, can I trust this? Is this going to actually be around or is it going to be totally changed next week or what? So I just think, you know, I just don't get it. I really don't get it. I wish someone would explain it to me. But I just don't understand. So it'd be good for a debate one day face-to-face with at a conference or something, I suppose.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we can have a conference in Chicago since I'm actually close to that rather than...
Where are you based, actually?
I'm in Cincinnati.
Oh, okay.
This is in Miami, Florida.
Yeah, cool. I'm way down in Miami.
Ah, well... Or you, right?
Yeah.
Well, you should come to one of our workshops one day. Hopefully, if you're in town.
Yeah, I saw you guys just sold out of the latest one. You're going to do
in 12 hours.
Yeah, so we've been doing this building a Basecamp workshop, and this is kind of part of our whole idea of giving back. You know, of course, we charge for it, but it's sharing our knowledge and our, you know, what we've learned and our experiences and our mistakes with people, so they can, you know, hopefully take something from this and learn themselves. So we've been doing this building a Basecamp workshop. We've done six of them, and they all sold out. We decided this time to do a lot more next year, but we're going to change it to this whole getting real. There's kind of this new thing we're working on as far as this book goes and some ideas. We're just kind of calling these getting real. It's going to incorporate stuff from Basecamp, Backpack, Brightboard, Ta-Da, and our other products that we're developing. So building a Basecamp just wasn't kind of a big enough name for it anymore. So we renamed it Getting Real, and we sold out 50 seats in 12 hours. It's $695 a pop. So, you know, we're pretty excited about that. We want to do more of these. And it's great to see that people think that what we have to say is valuable. And hopefully after they attend the workshop, they still agree with that. It's cool to get your message out in a lot of different ways, via a blog or via a workshop or speaking at conferences or doing podcasts or doing interviews, whatever. I find it very enjoyable just to share these ideas, and hopefully it makes a difference for people, especially since I think what we have to say is a bit non-conventional, which is kind of a good thing. I think people need to hear different points of view and different ways of doing things.
Yeah. It's always good to stretch your brain.
Absolutely.
Hey, if you give us seats, we'll be there.
Oh, will you? Okay.
Sure, why not?
We'll talk about that. Yeah, we just opened 5 more slots today, and we sold them out in about an hour. So,
hey, yeah. We're only 2 guys.
Yeah, we're probably not going to have any more seats available for this one, though. We're going to cap it at this level. But we'll probably be doing another one maybe in March or April or something. We'll let you know.
Excellent. Keep my open.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
I don't know. I think we covered a whole lot of stuff. Do you have any other questions?
I think that about wraps it up, actually.
I guess I'm pretty cool. If you guys have any follow-ups, let me know. But I think, you know, we covered VC, sort of. We covered small. We covered some of the product stuff. Covered some of our design philosophies, business philosophies, our background. We probably got most of it out there.
Yeah. Well, actually, who are you tapping on the desk?
That was me.
Okay. Like, what in the world is that? No, who would be, I guess, one thing I wanted to ask before was, who would you consider kind of a design gurus? Who do you follow and read about? Like Jacob Nielsen.
Sure.
What's your take on him?
I don't follow Nielsen much anymore. I think that Nielsen was a really good thing for the industry, though, when he first got going. I mean, he really legitimized usability for all of us. He was talking about usability, and the Wall Street Journal was listening, and the New York Times was listening, and that was really an important thing for the industry at the time. You know, I don't know if he's worn out as welcome or if he's still relevant. I honestly don't know. I don't follow him that much anymore. But I also suspect that I'm not his audience anymore. So I think he probably still has a very large audience of people who are just getting into this. And I think he probably has a lot of good things to say still. As far as like other people I look up to, look at a lot of things outside of the web design world. I really like architecture. I'm just a huge fan of architecture. I get a lot of inspiration from that. I get a lot of inspiration from just physical devices and physical products. Great industrial design really kind of drives me, makes me think about interface design a lot and how to simplify products. Nature, I think, is like one of the best things you can ever look at to get inspiration for simple solutions. Simple, tried and true solutions. I mean, over millions of years, these things have been developed. It's a lot of beta testing, you know, a lot of user testing along the way and coming up with kind of the best solution for right now. So I think nature's a great place to look. You know, I look around at the web and I look at designs and I'm impressed by a lot of stuff I see, but I mostly look for inspiration outside of a web design kind of world. Yeah, so that's what I look.
Thanks for being on the show, Jason.
Yeah, thanks.
Glad we finally caught up.
Thank you very much for having me. Sorry it took so long.
That's okay. This has been a SteelPixel production. For more information about SteelPixel, you can check out steelpixel.com. Or for more information about the show, feel free to check out web20show.com. That's web20show.com.